This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to harlemglobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
You ever get that feeling like you're drowning in financial news trying to figure out what's next for the market?
Oh, absolutely. It can feel like guesswork sometimes, can't it?
Yeah, exactly. And then the market just does its own thing anyway. But what if the real clues aren't in the headlines? What if they're, you know, right there in the price charts?
Well, that's pretty much the heart of technical analysis. And that's what we're diving into today, based on the material you sent us.
Right.
Excerpts from John J. Murphy's Technical Analysis of the Financial Markets. It's a bit of a classic in the field.
It really is. People call it the Bible of technical analysis sometimes. It started way back in 86, focused on futures then.
Mm-hmm.
But it's been updated, covers stocks now too. It's basically about reading the markets. Body language, I guess.
That's a great way to put it. And our mission today is really to unpack the core thinking behind Murphy's approach.
Mm-hmm.
What are the key ideas? And crucially, why could this give you, our listener, a sort of shortcut to understanding what makes markets tick, cutting through the noise?
Okay, let's jump in. What's the absolute fundamental idea here, according to Murphy?
So at its simplest, technical analysis is studying market action. That means price, volume, sometimes something called open interest.
Okay.
Mostly using charts, yeah. And the goal is trying to forecast future price trends. Murphy's really clear, though. It's not fortune telling.
Right. No crystal balls.
No. It's about probabilities based on patterns you can actually see. And it all kind of rests on three basic premises.
Three core ideas. All right. What are they?
First one. Market action discounts everything.
Discounts everything. What does that really mean?
It means basically that anything that could possibly affect a price, economic news, political stuff, investor psychology, company earnings, you name it, it's already reflected or discounted in the price you see on the chart.
Mm.
So the technical analyst doesn't get too lost in the why. They focus on the what. What is the price doing?
Huh. So if some amazing news comes out, but the price doesn't budge.
The technical analyst might say, well, the market knew. Or maybe the market's reaction itself is the real story.
Interesting. Okay, what's the second premise?
Second, prices move in trends. Seems kind of obvious, maybe.
Well, yeah, things go up or down.
Right, but the key insight is that once a trend gets going up, down, or even sideways, and no matter if it lasts for days or years, it tends to keep going.
Ah, okay. So finding that trend is key.
Finding the trend and riding it, that's a huge part of the goal in chart analysis. The trend is your friend.
Until the bend at the end. Yeah, heard that one. Okay, number three.
Third premise, history repeats itself.
Hmm. Okay, how so? Not like literally the same events.
No, not exactly. It's more about human psychology. People react to market situations with fear and greed, right?
Mm-hmm.
Those emotions haven't changed much over centuries.
Sure.
And those predictable human reactions tend to create recognizable patterns on price charts, patterns that have led to certain outcomes in the past.
So the thinking is, they might lead to similar outcomes again.
That's the idea. You study the past patterns in price, in volume, to understand what might be happening now and maybe anticipate what's next.
So this is really different from fundamental analysis then. They're looking at company books, management.
Exactly. Fundamental analysis asks, you know, what's this company really worth?
Yeah.
Based on its underlying business.
Right.
Technical analysis is more focused on what is the market actually doing? What's the consensus expressed through price and volume?
Asking different questions. One's what should be, the other's what is.
That's a really good distinction. And focusing on the what is gives technical analysis a potential edge in timing.
Ah, timing. That's always the tricky part.
Isn't it just? So fundamentals might tell you a stock is undervalued, maybe a whole sector looks good. But the chart, the technicals, can help you spot when the price action starts confirming that view, when buyers are actually stepping in.
So fundamentals for the what, technicals maybe for the when.
That's often how people use them together, yeah. Murphy makes the point they aren't enemies. Lots of people blend them. But for just getting a feel for market mood and direction quickly, technicals are pretty powerful.
And it works across different markets, stocks, futures, whatever.
Yep, very flexible. Stocks, bonds, futures, currencies. And different time frames too. Day trading, long-term investing.
Yeah.
The core ideas apply.
So the same principles work if you're looking at a 5-minute chart or a 5-year chart.
Broadly speaking, yes. Murphy even points out you can look at, say, commodity trends, or bond yields, using technical analysis to get hints about inflation or interest rates.
Wow, so like the market giving off signals about the wider economy.
Kinda, yeah, if you learn how to read them.
Now, you sometimes hear chartist, sometimes technical analyst. Is there a difference?
Historically, maybe. A chartist was really focused purely on the visual patterns on the charts. But Murphy explains the field's grown. There's a lot more quantitative stuff now, statistical methods. So technical analyst is broader. It includes charting, but also these other tools, though reading the chart is still, you know, fundamental.
Gotcha. More data involved now, but no system's perfect. What are the criticisms? Does Murphy talk about those?
He does. A big one is subjectivity.
Meaning?
Well, what looks like a clear pattern to me might look different to you. There's interpretation involved.
Right. Two people see the same clouds, imagine different shapes.
Exactly. Mm. And then there's the self-fulfilling prophecy idea.
Ah, like if enough people believe a certain price level is important.
Their buying or selling at that level actually makes it important. Their actions fulfill the expectation.
Makes sense. Anything else?
Well, there's the big theoretical challenge, the random walk theory.
Random walk? Sounds like prices are just unpredictable.
That's the gist of it, yeah. That future price changes are random and can't be predicted from past prices.
So how does a technical analyst respond to that?
They basically say, look at the charts. Murphy includes examples like figure 1.3 in the book, showing clear trends. They argue that visually, prices often don't look random. They move in persistent directions.
Yeah, when you see a strong uptrend, it definitely doesn't feel random.
Exactly. And Murphy stresses that while the tools might change, you know, with computers and all that, those core principles, market discounts everything, prices trend, history repeats, those are the bedrock. They remain constant.
Okay, that gives a really good grounding in the philosophy. So where does Murphy go next? The book mentions Dow theory.
Yeah, Dow theory. It's super important historically.
Yeah.
You could call it the granddaddy of technical analysis.
Granddaddy. Okay. Why is that?
Well, it comes from Charles Dow. Late 1800s, he co-founded Dow Jones and Company.
Ah, that Dow Jones. The industrial average.
The very same. Him and the transportation average. He never actually wrote one big book on his theory. But people pieced it together from his editorials in the Wall Street Journal. And those ideas, they basically laid the foundation for how we think about market trends using averages. Still relevant today.
Amazing. Okay, so what are the key ideas in Dow theory?
Well, first, it echoes that technical analysis principle. The averages discount everything. Dow believed the main market averages reflect all the known information.
Okay, similar start.
Second, he talked about three types of trends. There's the primary trend that's the big long-term move, like a major bull or bear market.
Right.
Then the secondary trend corrections or rallies within that primary trend, lasting weeks or months usually.
Okay, like waves in the tide.
Good analogy. And finally, minor trends, just the short-term wiggles, day-to-day, week-to-week stuff.
So layers of trends, got it.
Third big idea, primary trends have three phases. Mm. For a bull market, first is accumulation. Smart money starts buying quietly.
Before everyone else catches on.
Exactly. Then comes public participation. Trend is clear, news is good, everyone jumps in.
The main move.
Right. And finally, distribution. The early buyers start selling, things get frothy, maybe speculation takes over.
Uh-oh. Setting up for a potential top.
That's the idea. It describes the life cycle of a major trend.
It still sounds familiar today. What else?
Crucially, the averages must confirm each other. This was key for Dow. A new primary trend signal in, say, the industrials wasn't truly valid unless the transports confirmed it by moving in the same direction.
Why the transports?
Back then, if producers, industrials, were making stuff, the transports had to be shipping it for the economy to be genuinely strong. He wanted to see broad market agreement. Figure 2.2 in the book shows this confirmation idea.
Makes sense. You need confirmation.
Fifth, volume must confirm the trend. Just like we discussed earlier, volume should ideally expand in the direction of the main trend. More buying interest on the way up in a bull market, for instance.
Conviction behind the move.
Exactly. And the final tenet is basically inertia. A trend in motion tends to continue until there's a clear signal it's reversed. Trends don't just stop on a dime.
Okay, so Dow theory is like a framework for reading the market's pulse using these big averages.
That sums it up well.
Yeah.
Murphy does mention the criticisms, though. Like, the signals can be late. You might miss the first part of a move, waiting for confirmation.
Yeah, I can see that.
But still, its influence is huge. It really established the idea of market cycles and looking at the market as a whole.
Incredible how those century-old ideas still echo. Okay, so we have the why and the history. How do we actually see this market action? charts, right? Let's talk chart construction.
Right. You got to understand the tools. Murphy goes through the main types. Simplest is the line chart, just connects the closing prices over time.
Mm.
Easy to see the general direction.
Okay, just the line.
Then you have the bar chart. For each period, like a day, it shows the highs, the low, the opening price, and the closing price. Gives you more info about the trading range.
Open, high, low, close. The OHLC bar.
Exactly. And then candlestick charts. Murphy mentions these here and covers them more later, but they show that same OHLC data in a more visual way. Kind of highlights the battle between buyers and sellers during that period. Figure 3.4 shows one.
Yeah, candlesticks have that body and the wicks. Very visual.
They really are. Murphy also talks about scaling. Arithmetic versus logarithmic scales on the vertical price axis.
Oh, yeah. What's the difference there?
An arithmetic scale shows equal price changes as equal distances. So $10 to $20 looks the same distance as $110 to $120.
Okay.
A logarithmic or log scale shows equal percentage changes as equal distances. So a 100% jump from $10 to $20 takes up the same vertical space as a 100% jump from $50 to $100.
So for long-term charts where prices change massively, log scale gives a better perspective on growth rate.
Exactly. Better for comparing percentage moves over long periods. Figure 3.5 compares them visually.
Got it.
Then he details how the daily bar chart is made. The vertical line is the high-low range, little tick on the left for the open, tick on the right for the close. Figure 3.7 shows it clearly.
And volume, where does that fit in?
Usually shown as vertical bars along the bottom of the price chart. Super important, like we said, for gauging the intensity or conviction behind a price move.
More volume means more participation, more oomph.
Pretty much. And for futures markets, he introduces open interest.
Right, you mentioned that. What is it again?
It's the total number of contracts that are still open that haven't been closed out. Changes in open interest can tell you if new money is flowing into a market or flowing out, usually plotted below the volume.
Another layer of information.
Exactly. And he mentions weekly and monthly charts too, just longer term views using the same principles. The bottom line for Murphy here is that charts are just visual maps of supply and demand.
Okay, maps of supply and demand. So we've got our maps. What are the first landmarks we look for? The basic concepts of trend?
Absolutely fundamental. Trend is everything in technical analysis. Murphy really hammers this home. It's just the basic direction the market's heading.
Up, down, or sideways.
Exactly. Those are the three directions. And remember, from Dow theory, the three classifications, primary, secondary, minor, long-term, medium-term, short-term. The tide, the waves, the ripples.
Right. Got it. Layers again.
Within these trends, you find critical levels. Support and resistance.
Okay. What are those?
Support is a price level or area on the chart where buying interest is strong enough to overcome selling pressure. It tends to stop a decline, at least temporarily. Think of it as a floor. Figure 4.4B shows an example.
A price floor. Okay. Resistance.
The opposite. A price ceiling. It's a level where selling pressure overcomes buying pressure. And the advance is turned back. Figure 4.4A shows that.
Floor and ceiling. Makes sense.
What's really interesting is how these levels can switch roles. If a resistance level is broken decisively on the upside, it often becomes support on subsequent pullbacks.
Right.
The old ceiling becomes the new floor. Same thing in reverse. Broken support often becomes resistance. Figures 4.5A and 4.5B illustrate this.
Wow. Okay. Why does that happen?
Psychology, mostly. People remember where prices turned before. If they bought at resistance and got burned, they might sell there next time. If they missed buying at support, they might jump in if price revisits it. Murphy even notes how round numbers often act as psychological S&R levels.
Like $100 on a stock or $20,000 on an index.
Exactly. People just anchor to those numbers.
Fascinating. So support and resistance zones. What about trend lines?
Trend lines are another key tool. You draw an uptrend line by connecting a series of rising lows. A downtrend line connects a series of falling highs. Figures 4.6A and 4.6C show this.
So visually defining the trend.
Right. And the longer the trend line holds, the more times price tests it and bounces off.
The more significant it becomes.
Exactly. Murphy says you generally need at least 3 points to make a trend line valid. He also points out that brief, minor penetrations don't necessarily break the trend. Figure 4.9.
So a little dip below an uptrend line isn't automatically the end of the world.
Not necessarily. And just like support and resistance, trend lines can also reverse roles. A broken uptrend line can become resistance later, and a broken downtrend line can become support. Figures 4.NIPBG and 4.NOC show that.
These concepts seem interconnected.
Very much so. Murphy introduces other related ideas too, like the fan principle. Figures 4.11AC, where you draw multiple trend lines after one is broken.
Okay.
And channel lines, figures 4.16AB, drawn parallel to a trend line to create a price channel. Helps estimate potential price targets. He talks about the steepness of trend lines. Super steep ones are often unsustainable, figures 4.1 through 13, and how you might need to redraw trend lines as a trend matures. Lots of nuances there.
Definitely. He briefly mentions things like percentage retracements, speed resistance lines, GAN, and Fibonacci fans, more advanced stuff for later chapters. But the core takeaway is understand trends, support, resistance, and trend lines. Those are the absolute building blocks.
Okay, building blocks established. But trends don't last forever. What happens when they might be changing? That's where reversal patterns come in, right? It's exactly right. Major reversal patterns are chart formations that signal the existing trend is likely ending and a new trend in the opposite direction is about to begin.
Warning signs.
Pretty much.
Why?
Murphy lays out some common traits. First, there has to be an existing trend to reverse. Obvious, but important.
Can't reverse if you're going sideways.
Right. Often the first signal is the breaking of a major trend line. Bigger patterns usually lead to bigger price moves. Also, topping patterns tend to form quicker than bottoming patterns.
Interesting. Why is that?
Prices tend to fall faster than they rise. Fear is a quicker motivator than greed, maybe. Bottoms often involve lower volume and less volatility as the market kind of drifts. And usually, completing the pattern with a breakout on high volume is key confirmation.
Okay, those are good general points. What are the specific patterns to look for?
The classic is the head and shoulders top, very well known.
Heard of that one. How's it form?
You get an initial peak, left shoulder, then a rally to a higher peak, the head, then a decline, followed by another rally to a peak that's lower than the head, right shoulder. Figure 5.1B shows it.
Left shoulder, head, right shoulder.
Okay. Connecting the lows between those peaks gives you the neckline. A decisive break below that neckline is the sell signal.
And volume.
Volume is usually highest on the left shoulder, maybe lower on the head, and often quite low on the right shoulder. Then it should pick up significantly when the neckline breaks.
Got it. And there's an upside-down version.
Yep, the inverse head and shoulders. Same pattern, flipped over, signals a potential bottom and new uptrend.
Okay. What else signals a major turn?
You've got triple tops and bottoms, figures 5.4AB. Similar idea to head and shoulders, but the three peaks or troughs are roughly at the same level. Less common, maybe?
Three tries and couldn't break through.
But essentially, yeah. More common are double tops and bottoms, figures 5.5AB. Two distinct peaks at roughly the same resistance level, or two distinct troughs near the same support. Figure 5.5C shows a real example. Murphy cautions, though, real-world patterns are rarely perfect textbook examples.
We're gonna allow for some fuzziness.
Always. Then there are patterns like saucers or rounding bottoms, figure 5.8. These are slow, gradual turns, often taking a long time to form. Suggests a slow shift in sentiment.
Like a ship slowly turning.
Good image. The opposite is a spike or V reversal, figure 5.9. Very sharp, sudden turns. Often on high volume, maybe driven by a major news event. Harder to trade because they happen so fast.
Yeah, V-bonds can be tricky. So these patterns suggest the trend is probably over.
That's the main message, yes. A potential change in the primary direction is underway.
But sometimes the market just pauses, right? Takes a breath before continuing the trend.
Exactly. And that's where continuation patterns come in. These formations suggest the market is just consolidating before resuming the previous trend. They're pauses, not reversals.
Okay, consolidation patterns. What are the main ones?
Triangles are really common. Murphy describes three main types. Symmetrical triangles, figure 6.1a, where the upper and lower boundaries are converging. Kind of neutral, suggests indecision before a breakout, usually in the direction of the prior trend.
Coiling up like a spring.
Yeah. Then ascending triangles, figure 6.1b, with a flat top resistance and a rising lower boundary support, usually resolved with an upside breakout bullish.
Buyers getting more aggressive.
Right. And descending triangles, figure 6.1c, the opposite. Flat bottom support, falling upper boundary, resistance, usually breakdown bearish. Figure 6.1D shows a real symmetrical triangle.
Okay, triangles signal a pause and likely continuation. Any rules for them?
Yeah, volume typically dries up as the triangle forms, then surges on the breakout. And the breakout usually happens somewhere between halfway and three quarters of the way through the triangle's formation, horizontally speaking. Figure 6.2 shows how to measure a potential price target after the breakout too.
Useful. Any other continuation patterns?
Yep. Flags and pennants, figures 6.6AB. These are short-term patterns. They usually appear after a sharp, almost vertical price move, the flagpole.
Ah, the flagpole.
The flag is a small rectangle slanting against the flagpole trend. The pennant is similar, but a small triangle. Both represent brief profit-taking or consolidation before the sharp move resumes. Figure 6.7b shows some pennants.
Short, sharp pauses.
Exactly. Then you have wedges, figures 6.8ac, similar to triangles, but both boundary lines slope in the same direction, either up or down. A falling wedge, sloping down, is often bullish, breaking upwards. A rising wedge, sloping up, is often bearish, breaking downwards.
So the direction of the slant matters.
It does. And rectangles, figures 6.9ac, these are just sideways trading ranges, bounded by clear horizontal support and resistance. Basically a pause where price bounces between two levels before breaking out, usually in the prior trend's direction.
Like a holding pattern.
Precisely. Murphy also mentions the measured move concept, figures 6.10abb, the idea that after a consolidation pattern, the next price leg might be roughly equal in size to the move before the pattern.
So predicting the extent of the next move.
It's an estimate, yeah. He briefly touches on needing confirmation from other indicators too, but the main point is these patterns signal the trend is likely to keep going after the pause.
Okay, so we have reversals signaling a potential end, and continuations signaling a likely pause. Now, we keep mentioning volume, and for futures, open interest. How crucial are they in confirming these patterns?
Extremely crucial, according to Murphy. They're like the trust but verify part of chart analysis. Volume, again, is the number of shares or contracts traded.
Right.
You want to see volume confirm the price action. In a healthy uptrend, volume should ideally increase when prices rise and decrease when prices pull back. Figure 7.1 shows this. Shows enthusiasm on the upside, lack of pressure on the downside, vice versa for downtrends.
So strong volume on a breakout from a pattern makes it much more believable.
Absolutely. It's just conviction. Weak volume on a breakout might be a red flag.
Okay. And open interest in futures. Remind us of the rules there.
Right. Open interest is the number of active contracts. It tells you if money is flowing into or out of the market. Murphy lays out four scenarios, basically.
Let's hear them.
One, price up, open interest up, bullish. New money's coming in, supporting the rally.
Okay, strong sign.
Two, price up, open interest down, less bullish, maybe warning sign. Uptrend might be driven by short covering, not new buying.
Yeah.
Rally could be weak.
Got it. Shorts getting squeezed out.
Three, price down, open interest up, bearish. New money's coming in on the short side, fueling the decline.
Strong downtrend signal.
Four, price down, open interest down. Less bearish, maybe warning sign. Downtrend might just be longs liquidating, selling out. Selling pressure could dry up soon.
So OI adds a whole other dimension to analyzing futures trends.
It really does. The table on page 161 in the book summarizes these rules nicely. Figure 7.2 shows bearish OI confirmation. Murphy emphasizes again that rising volume confirming a breakout from any pattern in any market is a strong sign. Figure 7.4.
So price is primary, but volume and OI are key supporting actors.
Excellent way to put it. He also mentions how sometimes super high volume can actually mark the end of a trend, like a buying climax, blow off top, or a selling panic, selling
that
climax.
Austin moves.
Exactly. He briefly mentions other tools too, like the commitments of traders report for futures, looking at what different groups like commercial hedgers are doing, and option related sentiment indicators like put call ratios.
More advanced stuff.
Yeah. But the core message is, don't ignore volume and open interest. They provide critical context for price action.
Wow. Okay. This has been incredibly thorough. We've gone from the basic philosophy market discounts everything, trends, history repeats through Dow theory's foundations, how charts are built.
The core concepts of trend, support, resistance, trend lines.
Yeah. And then the major reversal patterns like head and shoulders, double tops.
And the continuation patterns like triangles and flags.
And finally, tying it together with the crucial role of volume and open interest. That's a lot packed in from Murphy's work.
It really is. But hopefully you, the listener, now have a much better handle on what technical analysts are actually looking at and thinking about when they look at a chart. It's a language, in a way.
Yeah, the language of the market itself. So practically, someone listening could now maybe look at a stock chart online or in the news and start to see these things, identify a trend line, maybe spot a potential support level.
Absolutely. It gives you a framework. Not investment advice, of course, but a way to understand the dynamics you're seeing to make more sense of price movements.
And like you said, this is really just scratching the surface of what's in Murphy's book, right? There are oscillators, indicators, Elliott wave, loads more.
Oh, yeah. It's called a comprehensive guide for a reason. We've covered the absolute foundations today, the essential building blocks upon which everything else rests. Consider it a really solid starting point.
Definitely feels that way. Okay, so a final thought for our listener to chew on. Based on all this, we started with that idea. Market action discounts everything.
Mm-hmm.
If you really take that on board, how might it change the way you react to, say, breathless news headlines about the economy or a company? Does it maybe shift your focus a little more towards, well, what is the chart actually doing in response?
That's a great question to ponder. Does the market's reaction tell a different story than the headlines? Something to think about?